Hello, this is Leon Daniels, and welcome to my regular podcast, Lunch with Leon. Every week, I invite one of my friends from around the world to come and have lunch with me. You can tune in and hear what we were talking about. It was great to catch up with my old friend Matt Ginsberg from Oregon, USA. Matt has had an amazing career as an entrepreneur, inventor, political columnist, and playwright. He's constructed crosswords for the New York Times, taught at Stanford, and has a doctorate in astrophysics from Oxford. He's also an author, and his first novel, Factor Man, was published in 2018. Go over to his website, mattginsberg.com. It's a great way to get a copy. Matt successfully developed software that enabled traffic to pass more smoothly and quickly through traffic signals by giving drivers clear advice about approach speeds. He's never let me forget I was the only traffic signal authority in the world who actually wanted to slow down the traffic, not speed it up. He regularly appears on stage either as a guest speaker or panel member, and these are at conferences and events internationally. As you will imagine, we had a really long lunch, and this is just part of it. By the way, it was recorded before President Trump caught the coronavirus and was admitted to hospital. Otherwise, I know we'd have discussed that too. So, Matt, it seems to me that we've spent the last few months doing about 5 years' worth of the natural trends that were there anyway. So there was a decline in high street retail. There was a decline in public transportation. There was an increase in working from home. There was an increase in online shopping. Is that what's happening with you?
It is. So we do as much of our shopping from home as we can. You know, you and I are having the same phone call I have with people who live 5 miles away from me as people who live 5,000 miles away from me, because that's the world today. I've been having a lot of fun, right? So every morning, every weekday morning at 8:30, I talk for an hour with someone just to get me out of the house, as it were. And I have, and the fact that there's no constraint on distance has been awesome. I've actually reconnected with a guy I knew 40 years ago at Oxford, and we drifted apart. And it was one of those things where we started talking and it was like we had never been apart at all, right? It was just, we picked up just like that. And, you know, now we talk every 3 weeks like clockwork, and we both look forward to it. And it's just so cool. His hair is grayer and there's less of it than when I knew him.
Same.
And we were both graduate students.
Same for all of us, yeah. And so I too have done that. I've picked up with people I know, but there was never time for these people. So that's a good thing, surely.
It is. And I think that I hope, so we are discovering efficiencies that we didn't know were there. And a huge one is the fact that you don't need to spend so much time traveling. I have a friend who is a pharmaceutical sales rep in Southern California. I talked to her and she told me that her sales, she's having the best year she ever had, but she's only working 10 hours a week. Because she is no longer driving, she's no longer spending 30 hours a week on the freeways in Los Angeles. And I have another friend who would be delighted to learn that you can reduce the congestion on the surface streets in London by simply allowing people to meet over video instead of meeting face to face. We are, but we're going to overdo it just because that's what we're like, right? So I think about my daughter's last quarter at Carleton being remote. She did not get the education I paid for. That is something that just needs to be face-to-face. I mean, I've taught at Stanford. I've taught at Oxford. And the idea that you can do that over video is sad. And I hope we don't. There are some things you just have to do face-to-face. And I hope we don't lose them as we rush to do less and less in someone else's physical presence.
And I think we're hearing that, aren't we? We're already hearing there is no creativity. There are those no chance meetings in the elevator, no chance meetings by the coffee machine, those chance groups of people that just get together and do some stuff, because everything we do, like we're doing now on Zoom, has to be arranged in advance. There's no random Zoom capability. So you and I had to agree to meet at a certain time. So our creativity is already partially stunted, isn't it?
So I do want to say that Skylar, my daughter, there was a website that came up, and I think it went away, and it actually was a random college dating website where you would be matched up. You'd go in pairs, and she went with her friend, and they would be matched up with two totally random guys who had also, and that they implemented this thing, and it was just, you know, it was just a hack, and the use was so overwhelming, it just crashed. So people are trying. And I think that will balance out. So look at my friend Steven, whom I'm back in touch with. It's not a random meeting. We have to organize it, but we have more of them. I think there are some, this is not complete, this interaction. So I'm looking at you, and I know you're eventually going to turn this into audio, so even that's going to disappear. And I see that your arms are crossed, and now they're not, because I see just enough of you. Now I can't tell. You might have recrossed them because you're like that. If I'm in a room with someone whose arms are crossed, sometimes it's just a relaxed position. Sometimes it's very defensive, and you actually need to tread with care. And there are a lot of these signals that are missing, and our communication will become less effective in important ways. And that's why teaching kids, they tell you if they're confused in these incredibly subtle ways, and I don't know if Zoom can capture.
So that's interesting you should say that. I deliberately fold my arms so that the person at the other end of this call, like you, doesn't suspect me of reading and writing my emails whilst I'm half listening to you. Because if I fold my arms, you can see my hands. And if you see my hands, then you know I'm not typing. But you are right, that's a different signal to the signal that folding your arms normally means, which is I'm being confrontational, or I'm not listening, or whatever it is. But I do it deliberately.
Because creating a barrier. You're creating a barrier.
Yeah. So I see, if I have my hands down like this, you can't see what my hands are doing. So I could easily be just typing away. In fact, sometimes I do. I'm not doing it now, but sometimes I do it. So I deliberately do this thing and fold my arms, because now you know I'm not typing. So now you know you have 100% of my attention.
You actually know anyway. I mean, when somebody starts reading their email, their response time goes up and their answers get shorter and slightly less to the point. But it is the case that there's an element that's missing.
But nevertheless, it is a case, isn't it? We have become very comfortable in our Zoom reality. And we are losing the ability to communicate, and we're even losing the will, we're even losing the appetite to go and do these things. And one of the reasons why I am as far ahead of the curve as I'm allowed to be legally here, like I'm traveling on public transportation, I'm eating in restaurants, and I'm traveling by air next week, is because I am desperate to get back to what for me was a more normal human interaction, including all the random interactions you get when you travel on public transportation and by air, because you are inadvertently put together with a series of random people, but I'm really keen to do that. Otherwise, we're just all locked in our homes.
But I hear you, and I think you're right. And we live on a house. I don't know if have I ever told you about where we live?
No, you told me where you live, but we've never discussed it in detail. You've never invited me. That's not true. You're always inviting me, and now I have the time to come. I'm not allowed to travel.
Yes. So we live on top of a mountain on 90 acres, and it's idyllic. It's just gorgeous, and it's so tempting to just stay here. But you're right. It's very easy just to be lazy and to let the personal elements languish. It's especially, I mean, in the States, we're idiots. We're morons. I assume we're the laughing stock of the rest of the world, because if we're not, we should be. You know, America is doing so phenomenally badly at managing this that I don't know where the right balance is. I know as a nation, we are not taking it seriously enough. We are still interacting socially and person to person too much. But I don't know what Europe is doing better. For all I know, Europe needs to interact more, because you guys are all turning into couch potatoes.
Well, so there is a business theory, as you know, that in the event of a serious, serious downturn in business, you should cut deeply and quickly, save as much as you can, and then dig your way out of it. So broadly, what happened in Europe and also in other countries was the lockdown was pretty quick and it was very effective. So in the UK, it was just at the end of March, but immediately everywhere was shut. Apart from fruit shops, everywhere was shut. You were told to stay indoors. You were allowed to go out for up to 1 hour for walking, exercise. You weren't allowed to go on public transportation unless you were an essential worker. I think what you're describing in the US is that that cut hard and cut quickly wasn't as deep or as effective as it should have been.
I actually think that's not true. I think that we, roughly speaking, did it right, and then we relaxed too early. We had a big disadvantage because college graduation, the college kids were unwilling not to party. And if I wish we had been, you know, a month ahead of ourselves. And July 4th, which is a huge holiday here, people were unwilling not to party. And keeping people inside in the summers is a lot harder than keeping them inside in the winters or earlier. So just, we're still idiots. I'm making no excuse, right? The whole world should be laughing at us. And if you aren't, you're only saving your laughter for a day you needed more, I think.
The trouble is, of course, is that lockdown is also the shutdown of the economy. So Boris Johnson gets some criticism for leaving the lockdown too late. But as you say, firstly, there is a finite period that people are prepared to be locked down for. And I truly believe that Boris left the lockdown as late as he reasonably could in order to make sure the period for which we were locked down was as short as possible. And I think he also knew that it would make a terrible effect on the economy. And that we're seeing that now as we come out of our lockdown. Terrible redundancies in manufacturing, in retail, and as the furloughing scheme we have, whereby the government is paying 80% of people's wages, is slowly turned off, then the people who still have had jobs but have been at home on 80% pay are being made redundant. So in this argument about the lockdown, the countervailing argument is that you need to get the economy restarted, because if there's no economy, then there is no money to pay for, in our case, the National Health Service, police, or any of the other public services that people rely on. So it seems to me the politicians are caught between the right thing to do to guarantee people's health and life expectancy and the thing they need to do to protect the economy. The two things don't sit comfortably together.
There's certainly tension, but nobody knows, right? So there's going to be a vaccine. I've been saying since March it was going to be at Thanksgiving, which is the end of November in the States. I'm actually standing by that. I still think that's about right. It matters enormously in the States whether it's before or after the general election at the beginning of November, and it's close. So there's going to be a vaccine, and there's going to be an afterwards and we will see how right you are. I think you're not going to be terribly right on this. I think the economy is going to recover recover. It's going to get back to a new normal with extraordinary speed.
Humans are very resilient. There's plenty in that argument. But equally, if you have an old car battery that's been allowed to go flat and remain flat for too long, it doesn't have the chemical ability to recharge.
Well, I understand. So you're saying you could be right. And I agree that you could be right. I just don't think you will be. Let me give you, there's one piece of data on this. I don't think anybody knows, except I give you the following data. Shortly before the pandemic hit, so I work out every morning and I hate it. And I watch TV while I'm doing it. And I decided that what I was going to do was I was going to watch all of the best picture winners of all time, starting with the first one, which is a 1929 silent movie called Wings. And I later added a bunch of early pre-Academy Award movies. So I've watched a distressingly large number of movies made between 1915 and I'm up to 1954. Many of the movies from around 1930 are biopics. They are biographies of either a real or a fictional family. And typically they start in around 1890 and go to whatever the then present day was, in extraordinary detail. So there is a ton of information about World War I always. There's a ton of information about the Boer War. There's a ton of information about how Oklahoma is this really weird shape. It has this long skinny bit. How they got the long skinny bit from the Cherokee Indian. History is covered in enormous detail. How many times do you believe the Spanish flu pandemic is mentioned in all of these movies?
Let me guess, none.
Correct. After it was over, it was over. It was, and some of the actors, I looked up the actors just because I was curious and I mostly wanted to know if any of them were still alive. Some of them had the Spanish flu. Some of them recovered from the Spanish flu. When the pandemic was over, it was over. People moved, when they went back to normal. It is not, we are going to be hugging just like we always used to be hugging. I hope and I expect. So I believe that society will do its utmost to put this behind us as quickly as we can. And I hear you on the car battery analogy. And there are things that we will not be able to do because the battery will be bad. But there are a lot of efficiencies we are picking up, like this phone call. We're going to use less carbon. So there are a bunch of good things happening. And as soon as we can interact like we used to, I expect we will go back to doing so quite quickly. Now, a lot of department store chains are still going to be out of business. You know, there are going to be 5 years of changes compressed into 9 months. But I think it's going to be a world that we will all recognize before and after.
That's an interesting thought, which I've expressed before, which is we've had 5 years worth of ongoing trends in the last 6 to 9 months. So the online shopping, the decline of high street retail, it's all been compressed into a time. But in your view, that compression is too severe for there not to be any casualties. Is that right?
Yes. So there's going to be pain. I don't know, but it's going to be more pain in total. So I think there are going to be a lot of people who go through enormous pain that could have been spread out over a long period. We're not going to do as well by them. The people who lose their jobs, we're not going to have the opportunity to figure it out in a way that we would have. And we might have squandered that opportunity, but we would have had a chance. But I don't know that it's going to be more total pain at the end of the day than the next 5 years. I mean, we're going through this revolution. Revolutions help and hurt. And this accelerated. I just hope we get to slow down again.
The last time you were in London, I think, was for MOOC at XL.
It was.
And you were, I think, running a panel discussion. And I remember from that, we had been talking about autonomous vehicles, which I know is a subject you have strong views about. And we were also talking about data protection. So in any order you like, except I insist as part of data protection, you tell my listeners about your Tesla.
So I have a Tesla. I don't like the fact that they track everywhere I go, whether I want to or not. I asked my son when he was 16, I asked him what privacy was. And he told me privacy is when the people who know your secrets don't use them to hurt you. And I told him he was insane. I said, that is not privacy. Privacy is when nobody knows your secrets. And he has come to his senses. I have recounted this to him, and he said, I was wrong. I can't believe it. Are you really sure I said that? That is just wrong. But it's what he felt when he was 16. And Tesla is clearly on the wrong side of this, right? They know, I mean, I don't have any secrets, but they know where I go. And that's bad. It's bad that Google knows as much about me as they do.
But that move, when you were in London, your colleague on stage, the lady also from the US, she said, look, I rather like it that Amazon know I like blue dresses. And when there's a deal on blue dresses, they offer them to me. And they know that my husband buys books about the Civil War. So when there's a new book on the Civil War, they offer it to me so that I can buy for his birthday. And I rather like all of the things that them knowing about your personal preferences and so on offers to you. And frankly, since I'm an upstanding citizen doing no harm, what have I got to be frightened of?
Yeah, I hope she never realizes just how fraught with peril that path is. And just to give you a probably not, you know, so I can easily imagine a world where a recovered alcoholic, or recovering, I guess you can never really completely recover, holds political office and is working on a bill that will damage Amazon in some way. As Amazon releases the information that this individual bought 5 bottles of very expensive scotch, and his alcoholism is known and it's a matter of public record, and he bought them as a gift, but it doesn't matter because they destroy him. Amazon's advantage to doing this. And nobody should know. It just shouldn't. I mean, Europe is so far ahead of the United States in terms of protecting personal data. You know, Google's motto for a long time was do no evil. And they eventually decided that was not going to be their motto. That's terrible. Because eventually, historically, when someone has the capacity to do enormous evil, they eventually do. You know, maybe Bryn and Paige are good guys, and maybe Hennessy, I think, who currently runs Alphabet, is a good guy. But eventually there's going to be somebody who's not a good guy. And, you know, power corrupt, blah, blah, blah. So I get the benefits. I understand that it would be nice if Amazon magically figured out what I wanted and told me. And I spent all sorts of time looking at these news articles about, you know, great gifts for dads, hoping that one of them is going to be just what I want. And I do look, you know, Amazon, I mean, I go to the Factor Man page all the time to see how Factor Man is doing. And Amazon has got these very bizarre views of what I'm interested in, because I'm interested in my own book and almost nothing else. I think we will collectively regret the extent to which we are currently being so cavalier with information that is far more personal than we realize. I mean, I've done AI for the last, since 1983, and most of my professional career. And what we can do with that information is scary. And it's really, I think if people understood the true value of the information they were relinquishing, they would hold it much more tightly. Yeah, it's nice to know that I like blue dresses. Well, unless I'm a politician, and then if I like blue dresses, I'm in trouble. But it's nice to know that I would be interested in following a product. It saves me time. But the cost is phenomenal, potentially phenomenal.
Do tell us the story about you not signing the Tesla data sharing agreement.
I don't even remember.
Your sat nav stopped working.
They made me, eventually I had to sign it. They were going to basically disable my car. And I told them I didn't want them to keep all my data. And they said, well, in that case, we're not going to offer you real-time traffic on maps. We're not going to be able to offer you support. And I signed it. I gave in because I wanted my car to keep working. I'm not a big Elon Musk fan. I think that's just how they do business, right? I think Facebook is a much bigger culprit than Tesla. I finally broke down and got a Facebook account, but I have no friends. And I live this totally iconoclastic Facebook life. Because there, I think it's very clear that they're not concerned with protecting your privacy. And with Tesla, I just don't know.
And we also talked before about autonomous vehicles. And I think you know my contention on autonomous vehicles is that it's coming. And it's coming progressively. So this is not like we used to drive on the right side of the street, now we drive on the left side of the street, and at midnight everything changes. That it's just happening progressively. You buy a new car, now it comes with dynamic cruise control, it comes with lane keeping assist, it comes with automatic parking, and so on. And so basically progressively, autonomous features are being added to regular cars that people buy. So eventually it'll be a short step between you needing to be taking any actions at all and not being able to take any actions, not needing to take any. And we'll be all the better for it, because in the UK, manually driven cars happily kill 1,500 people a year. That's 3 or 4 a day. And autonomous vehicles won't be perfect, but let's pretend the number's 200. You know, that's still 1,300 people a year that will be alive because the system was safer. It also presumes, in my mind, that this distinction that we have on autonomous vehicles, I don't believe they will just be driving on the types of roads and highways that we currently have. The onset of autonomous vehicles will give us other opportunities. So, for example, your zero emission small autonomous vehicle could drive through Selfridges. You could be driving through retail. You could be driving through your home. So this distinction between polluting vehicles that are on wheels that are in streets and what we do in buildings and so on will also become blurred. So that's my contention.
So I don't say this very often. I don't know that I've ever said it. Leon, you're just wrong. And let me tell you why. Because you got all the facts right, your conclusion is what's just wrong. So there's a bunch of autonomous vehicle stuff that is fundamentally easy. It's not actually easy, but it's just a matter of deciding you're going to do it. And that's everything we've got from lane keep, dynamic cruise control, et cetera, et cetera. And then you've got the stuff that's hard. And I'm going to give you a couple of anonymous stories, because I don't want to get anybody in trouble. A couple of people that I knew who were in the autonomous vehicle world. And they both started with stars in their eyes. They both started, they said, our company has a plan. We have a 2-year plan, and at the end of it, we're going to have autonomous vehicles. And we're just going to do A and B and C and D and E and bang, bang, bang. We're going to knock them all down, and then we're going to be done. And I smiled and said, okay, I'll check back with you. That particular person doesn't work in the autonomous vehicle space anymore. And then what happened was exactly what I expected. They knocked down the easy ones, and then they hit the first hard one, and they were just done. They just couldn't solve the hard problems. Another one was dealing with a situation where they had a hard problem. It was a hard problem from an AI perspective. And the way they solved it was they changed the map. They just changed the underlying map and declared victory. That doesn't count. That is not victory. That is defeat. That is absolute and utter defeat. Again, the hard problem that the AV guys have to solve are so profoundly hard at every level. I've spent a lot of time working on traffic lights and a vision system. The way they decide a vision system is good is because 98% of the time, the thing is actually in the list of the top 5 things it might be. Not its number one, it's in the top 5. That is not good with red lights. That doesn't work. You need more accuracy, and you have to just get it. You can't say, well, there are 5 things this could be, and one of them is a red light. No. If you think it's a red light, and it's a person with an umbrella, and you stop, and the guy behind you drives, it's just bad. So these problems will eventually be solved, right? There's no technical problem that mankind has simply beaten us. But they're unbelievably hard. And the reason I think they're never going to be autonomous cars is because I look at the problems faced by the autonomous car community, and then I look at the problems faced by the autonomous drone community. They're going to be done. There are autonomous drones are absolutely coming. All the problems they have to face, they have to face 2 problems. One is battery, and one is deconfliction, and that's really it. They know how to do everything else. The battery problems are going to get solved. They're already being solved. You can do it with gas if you're willing, so they're going to solve those. And deconfliction is trivial, right? You just have beacons, and you just do it. And you don't have to worry about, is there a little old lady crossing the road pushing a shopping cart? Because she's not going to be doing it 1,000 feet off the ground. There's really not, and you restrict the range to whatever you have to avoid, normal air traffic. And that's going to be how we get around. And the estimates I see for when that's going to be real are somewhere in the early to mid 2020s. I think that's probably right. And the estimate for when people are really going to have autonomous cars, they're way far away. They're much for, there are people, Elon Musk, again, he will tell you 2021. I mean, he's always going to have it in the next 12 months, but it's not getting closer. So I don't see solving the autonomous problem. I think the autonomous drones, they're just going to kill us all. And if you want to go somewhere, you'll just call one up and it'll show up and you'll get in and you'll go there. And it should be very cool. It's going to be faster. It's going to be safer.
And same for deliveries?
Yeah. There are going to be areas everywhere, 100 yards apart. You're not going to need roads, right? So there are going to be all these areas 100 yards apart. And, if you want, my wife does a lot of equestrian stuff. She'll be able to order a drone. It'll be more expensive. She'll be able to order a drone, and she can just pile on with her horse, and off she goes. I think that It may well be the case. I mean, there are issues with drones. They're not as energy efficient. So I think it may well be the case if you're traveling long distances, you take a drone to a train, to a drone to where you're going. So the drones will be the first and last mile, 10 miles, what have you. Trains are enormously efficient. They're enormously safe. Autonomous trains are easy. You know that. So that's why I think no autonomous cars. Too hard. There are other solutions that are going to work better, faster.
So we won't get to autonomous vehicles, not because it's impossible. It's just their replacement will arrive sooner and eclipse them.
Yeah, they're going to be overtaken by events.
So I wanted to share this story with you because I know you like the perverse outcomes from what are actually systemic failures. The story I loved, so you may have already heard it, it's the 2017 Oscars trouble with Warren Beatty and Faye Dunaway reading out the wrong...
Yes.
So I was fascinated to learn. Somebody did an investigation. For our listeners, what happened is was that Emma Stone had just won the Oscar for the best actress in La La Land. And as she went off stage, Warren Beatty and Faye Dunaway came on to do the best movie. And Warren Beatty announced it as La La Land. But in fact, he'd been given the card from the previous winner. So there's a number of things in this, which are everything you know about systems. So it now becomes clear that there are two sets of cards. And the reason there are two sets of cards is that they travel with different couriers from different locations in order to make sure that at least one gets through. But the control over those cards falls apart when it arrives at the theaters. The second problem in this story is we have to remember that Warren Beatty and Faye Dunaway are pre-programmed. He's also not young. He's 80. So he's programmed to say out the name of a film. And if you examine the card, the biggest word on the card is Oscars. You know, just in case you were confused as to why you were in a big auditorium with thousands of people on an evening, it's the biggest word is Oscars. The smallest word is best movie. And the words in the middle, which are of equal height, says best actress, La La Land. So, of course, if you're programmed to read the name of a film and it's not the biggest word on the card or the only word on the card, you are compelled to read out the name of the film. So he read out La La Land, which was entirely wrong. They had not won the Oscars. And that's entirely down to the fact that there's no control over two sets of cards. And because there were more words printed on the card than was necessary, because the only words you want to print on the card are the words you want the 80-year-old onstage actor to say. Because if you control the cards and you only put the right words on, then you stand a much higher chance of success than you do. And I love that story because it's about systems and it's about typography. And as we know, there was a lot of press coverage afterwards about a whole series of things. And one of the things I was distressed to learn that as part of the precautions that have been put in place to make sure it never happens again, there are now three sets of cards. Isn't that great?
Stuff breaks.
If it is going to go wrong, it will go wrong.
Roughly speaking. And, you know, and that's come up so often in our conversation today, right? So when I say privacy, maybe the guys running Alphabet today are benign, but that is something that can go wrong with catastrophic effect. And someday it will. Autonomous vehicles. People are still going to die getting from A to B. You just can't, you know, and the goal is to make getting from A to B as convenient and safe as possible, including safety for everyone else. So, you know, low emission vehicles mean that some other guy somewhere else didn't die because of carbon disasters and global warming. People are still going to die. And the question is, how do you make it as effective as possible? And there, I think the answer is actually relatively clear. The drones are just going to be, they're going to be sooner, they're going to be safer, they're going to be better, they're going to be cleaner in many ways. And I think they're there tomorrow. But on all these things, you know, screw-ups happen. People make mistakes. We will keep doing so. You know, you and I have spoken about the difference between custodians and entrepreneurs. Entrepreneurs are supposed to make mistakes, right? That's our job. Our job is to try so much, so fast, knowing that a lot of it's going to go wrong, but the stuff that doesn't go wrong moves the world forward. And then you have people on the other side whose job is to keep the entrepreneurs in check, because if they were left to their own devices, they would run amok and nothing would ever work. And they wouldn't even care. So you have these people on the other side who are responsible for keeping things running smoothly. And it's good that it's that way, right? Those are the checks and balances you're supposed to have.
I cannot fail to remember that slide you presented about the difference between entrepreneurs and regulators. Because at the time you were an entrepreneur and I was a regulator.
Yes.
And you proved, and we all speak a different language, because you proved, you said, I'm an entrepreneur. I like to try doing things. If I get one thing in 10 right, I'm doing really well. And I like to take risk. And you guys are regulators and you don't want to take any risks. For you, you've got to get 9.5 things out of 10 right. Otherwise, you get fired. And you'd just rather go carefully and make no mistakes, which is the essence of your contention, which is how on earth can entrepreneurs speak to regulators when you are divided by a common language?
Yes. But the answer is it's not really that hard, right? So the trick is to realize, for the entrepreneurs to realize that the regulators, much better word than custodian, that the regulators are essential to their own success. And for the regulators to realize that the entrepreneurs are essential to their success. And if we both realize, and this is what I was saying in the talk that you are referring to, if we both just realize how important the other side of the coin is, I mean, you and I have always gotten along great. We've always talked productively. We've always listened to each other. And that's the hurdle, right? Just to get to the point where we actually want to hear what the other side is saying. So Tesla reopened in California when it was illegal to do so. That's Elon Musk refusing to listen to the regulators. That's bad. It worked out okay. He got lucky, but it's not how the system is supposed to work. The system needs to be working together to get mankind to the future that we all hope awaits all of us.
So there we have Matt Ginsberg, who's been talking with us today on a whole load of things, not just autonomous vehicles, not just the effect of the coronavirus, but also some world-changing things that we all have to think about as we replan our futures in the post-coronavirus era. So Matt, as always, it's been a great pleasure talking with you. We always have great fun. We always enjoy these times. And I know everybody listening to this has really enjoyed it as well. So we've had Matt Ginsberg, and I'm talking to you with Lunch with Leon, which is an itthub.net production. Really thank you for joining us. Please go to the website and subscribe. Please do come on and tell us everything you want to tell us about what you've heard on the show, what you'd like to hear on the show, and the people you'd like to see and hear from, and even, of course, the people you'd like to hear from again. And in the meantime, thanks very much indeed to Matt Ginsberg, talking to us all the way from Oregon, United States of America.